Peter B. Collins. News and comment here on Monday, December 10, 2012. Until this weekend, you could not read in the New York Times about the court-martial proceedings underway in Fort Meade, Maryland, against Private First Class Bradley Manning. And in the Sunday paper, I want to give a shout-out to Margaret Sullivan. She is the newly minted public editor. I think she's been on duty just a few months now. And she correctly excoriates her own newspaper for its failure to cover this very important story, a story that the New York Times has directly benefited from, because it published at no cost in terms of court trials or any kind of sanctions the products of Bradley Manning's leaks. And we can now dispense with the alleged and all that, because the Manning legal team has acknowledged that Bradley Manning is responsible for the disclosure of all the troves of WikiLeaks documents. And Margaret Sullivan, public editor at the New York Times, details the importance of the story and the failure of the Times to cover it until the day before. That's right. Front page of Saturday's edition, the least read edition of the week, by the way, they put two able reporters, Charlie Savage and Scott Shane, on the case. And we got, I didn't measure it, but looks like about 15 column inches of coverage. And some of it was even fair to Bradley Manning. But the important part is here, why did the New York Times ignore this important story until it was about to be embarrassed by its own public editor publishing a valid critique? And certainly the editors of the paper knew before Saturday morning, or before the Saturday morning edition went to bed in newspaper parlance, that Margaret Sullivan was going to criticize the paper for this failing. And so they snuck in just under the wire with what she referred to as a catch-up story. She wrote, "I was glad the Times got into the game, even if very late, with a reporter in the courtroom on Friday for the ninth day of the hearing, and a catch-up article on the front page on Saturday." But when she emailed senior editors at her newspaper about why there had been no Times reporter at the hearing at all until Friday, the Washington bureau chief, David Leonhardt, explained that the Times had already covered the most important aspects of the testimony, referring to two articles that appeared 19 months ago. Wow. Now, as you know, I regard Bradley Manning as a national hero. The laptop computer I carry has a free Bradley Manning sticker on it. While I was on vacation in Hawaii, a guy at a Starbucks came up and commented on it. And, you know, once you put a sticker like that on, you don't think about it every time, every day, every moment. But out of the blue, he walked up and said, "Hey, that's cool. I support Bradley Manning." And I believe that this is a deep embarrassment to the Obama administration's claim of transparency. And the pretrial detention, the barbaric treatment of Bradley Manning, is what has been aired out in this courtroom. And why did the Times feel that wasn't newsworthy, not worth dispatching a reporter, not worth devoting some coverage? Well, I can't explain. But as I said, the story in Saturday's paper did include some fair statements. Here's one. It seemed incongruous that Manning has essentially acknowledged responsibility for the largest leak of classified material in history, including 250,000 State Department cables whose release have chilled diplomats' ability to do their work discreetly, but also helped fuel the Arab Spring. Video of the American helicopter crews shooting people on the ground in Baghdad who they thought were enemy fighters but were actually Reuters journalists? Well, that's pretty generous on the part of the Times. When I watched that videotape, the comments of the people on the radio guiding that chopper in for the kill didn't really seem to think that. They were just shooting at moving targets. It goes on, field reports on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and confidential assessments of the detainees locked up at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. It doesn't quite mention how much the Times has benefited from the courageous acts and great risks taken by Bradley Manning. We're gearing up for a military assault on Syria. The indications are clear. Over the weekend, 3,000 American troops secretly returned to Iraq via Kuwait. And they have been staged there due to recent developments in Syria and northern Iraq, according to Press TV. The U.S. troops have been secretly entering Iraq in multiple stages, or mostly stationed at the Balad military garrison in Salahuddin province and the Al-Asad air base in Al-Anbar province. Includes army officers, and it says that up to 17,000 more are set to secretly return to Iraq in the near future. Not too much secret these days. But we keep secret wars. The drones are secret. There's so much secrecy that drives you crazy. On another front related to Syria, Press TV also reports that we are now planning to send sophisticated weapons to foreign-sponsored militants fighting the Syrian government. Americans have bought weapons that were used by the Libyan government of Muammar Gaddafi, including Russian-made Strela 2 missiles and an SA-7, which is a man-portable, shoulder-fired, low-altitude surface-to-air missile system. And so whatever has been covert, the C is fading. That's the letter C. And it's becoming more overt by the day. We'll be continuing to watch this very carefully. Once again, we have slain the number two leader in Al-Qaeda in the remote provinces of Pakistan, using one of those secret drones. And this is always so bizarre, because when we conduct an alleged kill like this, the U.S. government takes credit, and it's not a secret that we used a drone. But when you want to talk about innocent civilians being killed by drone strikes like this, well, that's a secret. At any rate, the man whose nom de guerre is Al-Kuwaiti, real name Sheikh Khalid bin Abdel Rahman Al-Husseinin, was in a house near Mir Ali, one of the main towns in North Waziristan, when a Hellfire missile fired from an American drone landed and killed him. No indication if other people, perhaps innocent people, were also killed at the same time. And then on Sunday, four drone-launched missiles blew apart another house near Miran Shah, a main town in North Waziristan, killing three suspected militants, but were not offered any names about that. Oh, I do see that Al-Kuwaiti's wife and daughter were wounded in the drone strike, and the wife died a day later. In Egypt, Mohamed Morsi is still under fire, under a lot of pressure as the crisis continues. Over the weekend, he met with some of his opponents and agreed to rescind most of the sweeping November 22nd decree that temporarily elevated his decisions above judicial review. But it appears the protesters are not satisfied because Morsi continues to push for the referendum this coming Saturday, December 15th, on a new constitution that was drafted in a hurry apparently by a small group of his Islamic buddies. This one may go on for some time. There is a report that has been delivered to the Select Committee on Intelligence of the United States Senate, chaired by California Senator Dianne Feinstein. A 6,000-page report, the most definitive review of the CIA's program of detention, interrogation, and rendition of terror suspects. But like the drone program and so many other things, it's secret. We may never see it. And Republicans have criticized the inquiry into detention, interrogation, and rendition that occurred under George W. Bush. But then Attorney General Eric Holder announced this August that he wouldn't bring any criminal charges against the Bush Co. gang. And so the Republicans appear to be back on board with this report, but not, of course, releasing it to the American public. And according to Reuters, the Senate report focuses on whether enhanced interrogation tactics, torture is what I call it, including waterboarding, sleep depth, and other techniques, actually led to critical intelligence breakthroughs. Don't you think the American people deserve to know the substance of this report and whether torture worked? Because there's no evidence that it did. Only in the minds of people who watch 24 and this new show called Homeland. And yet, there's a new movie about the Bin Laden snatch by SEAL Team 6. Not the one that was on the National Geographic channel, but one that's out as a feature film. And it uses the same premise. That torturing suspects led to the knowledge of the courier that led to the location of Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad. And they are so desperate to come up with proof that torture worked and that it is therefore justifiable and can be rationalized. And it's flat out wrong. Will we ever get to see that report? I don't know. I just don't know. Roy Zimmerman, can you sing us a little ditty here about the dizzying array of alphabet soup in the intelligence and military communities?
I took a correspondence class in wiretapping and assassination. I learned the lingo and the proper etiquette for covert operation. I got my degree in top secrecy, 'cause I'm gonna be a spy for the CIDIATFBI.
You get the idea. There is, inside the Pentagon, an intelligence division called the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA. And in the new bill that was passed 98 to zip in the Senate to provide the budget for the Pentagon in the coming year, over $700 billion, by the way, that can't be cut to balance the budget or cut the debt, they barred the Pentagon from using funds to expand its spy ranks until it has provided more details on what the program will cost and how the extra spies would be used. And as a number of guests in my podcast interviews have recently suggested, the departure of David Petraeus, the launch of a second term of the Obama presidency, gives us a unique opportunity to revise our strategies, review and see what's been working and what hasn't. And we could realign so that the CIA no longer has drones and conducts paramilitary operations. It's a pure intelligence agency, as it was intended. And that the Pentagon doesn't have spies around the world. They rely on the CIA for that. And the Pentagon runs military operations. Now, these are in some ways just moving the boxes around. But the duplication of these efforts is only costing us money and compromising our own rights in this country and compromising the future of American foreign policy because, as we learned from Stephen Johnson, Gregory Johnson from Princeton University in our interview last week, Our drone strikes, run by the CIA in Yemen, are not decapitating this new group, Al-Qaeda, on the Arabian Peninsula, as we claim. The drone strikes cause more people to join the effort against the United States. And at minimum, it's rational and sensible, if only on a cost savings basis, to stop the creep of militarization at the CIA and in the intelligence community, and stop the creep of espionage on the military side. Let the War Department run the war, and let the intelligence community provide what passes as intelligence. Also in the United States Senate, the battle is shaping up right into the new year over the filibuster. Last week, we saw Mitch McConnell forced into filibustering himself, a bill that he had just proposed regarding the debt ceiling. His bluff was called. But what you may not know is that there's also a legal challenge working its way through the courts about the Senate filibuster and whether it's constitutional. And some great Democratic lawmakers, my friend Keith Ellison from Minnesota, Hank Johnson from Georgia, John Lewis from Georgia, I've met him, he's an American hero, and Mike Michaud of Maine, have joined three citizens, or, well, they're actually residents who are not citizens. They've been denied a path to American citizenship because of filibusters. And so we have advocates and those who claim to be victims of the excessive filibuster that has been used by Republicans, particularly in this past 4 years since Obama became president. The numbers? Between 1840 and 1900, a 60-year period, there were only 16 filibusters. Between 2009 and 2010, there were more than 130. And so this court case is moving forward. It's been set for consideration Monday at the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C., If you want to follow it, it's Common Cause et al. Versus Biden et al. President Obama flew to Detroit, and he is stumping on the fiscal cliff, calling for tax hikes on the wealthiest. And while he was there, he actually mentioned the retrograde legislation pumped out of Lansing last week that would make Michigan one of the bedrocks of American labor unions, the auto workers, into a right-to-work state. And it is likely that perhaps as soon as you hear this podcast, that Governor Rick Snyder is going to sign this legislation into law, probably on Tuesday. And to be fair to Obama, it came very quickly. They just introduced it last week. They rammed it through, and it's going to become law this week. But Obama owes labor in this country a whole lot, like the 2008 election, the 2012 election. He didn't deliver diddly. He never went to Wisconsin to fight the efforts to eviscerate unions there. He showed up in Ohio on Labor Day last year and did speak out once in favor of the repeal of, I think it was called Senate Bill 5 in Ohio, that eviscerated public unions. But this trip to Detroit is really only the second time that he has been outspoken against the efforts to kill organized labor in this country. In his remarks, he lashed out at state legislators who were pushing right to work, telling the auto workers he spoke to that it was akin to taking away your rights to bargain for better wages and working conditions. That is correct. You got to do more, Mr. President. You're on the right page. Keep turning it, will you? Now, this is the same president who restricted corporate contributions to his first inaugural 4 years ago. No problem with that this year. The Obama finance team is offering corporations and others who contribute $1 million exclusive access to an array of inaugural festivities, including a benefactor's reception, a children's concert, candlelight, blah, 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 blah. Individuals who contribute $250,000 will receive the same package as million-dollar institutional donors. Well, he should be forced to wear the corporate logos of the big donors, $1 million or more, on his suit coat on Inauguration Day. I know that won't happen, but put him in a NASCAR race suit and put those logos on there. That's the right way to deal with that. The climate talks in Doha, Qatar, have ended. They basically extended the Kyoto protocols that the United States and other major polluters have never agreed to. And this is so tragic. I mean, there's some minor moves that come from this conference. But the outright denial of climate change, despite Hurricane Sandy, despite all of the available evidence, the melting of the glaciers, the warming of the waters, the death of reefs, it's all very clear. And yet, we are slow walking this because we're afraid of our own coal industries, oil industries, the money that they raise, and the political pressure that they produce. And my friend Steve Pizzo sent me a link to Science Daily, which reports on a new study that renewable energy could fully power a large electric grid 99.9% of the time by 2030 at costs comparable to today's electricity rates. A well-designed combination of wind, solar, and storage and batteries and fuel cells would nearly always exceed electricity demands while keeping costs low. Co-author of the study, Willett Kempton, professor in the School of Marine Science and Policy at the University of Delaware, said the key is to get the right combination of electricity sources and storage and to calculate costs correctly. So it's achievable. We could wean ourselves from fossil fuels in the next 15 to 20 years. We only need the will and the capital to do so. But the capital is controlled by either the political system or the corporate system. And they're not willing to play that game. And finally, an update on fracking. And we brought you a great report on Friday with Deborah Rogers, the Texas activist and a financial analyst, and our contributor Steve Horn of DSmog Blog. And this is a minor victory because down in the oil patch, the Texas Railroad Commission, which has the jurisdiction over oil and gas extraction, has put together new rules, with apologies to Bill Maher, and they have decided to address the process of drilling, from the drilling itself to the cementing and completing of an oil or gas well, and these also affect fracking. And what they're telling us is that they're going to have some rules about what they call well integrity, and involves placing protective cement between layers of pipe in an oil or gas well. Now, this doesn't address all of the issues, and we have a problem of federal preemption of state and local control of hydraulic fracturing. That was rammed through during Dick Cheney's presidency. But for an oil-dominated state like Texas to recognize the need to update rules about drilling and to protect aquifers from the fracking-related fluids that leak into the groundwater, well, that's kind of remarkable. And on that note, friends, I'm going to saddle up Trigger here and ride off into the sunset in West Texas. Mighty fine of you to listen, and you're welcome to share this podcast far and wide because it's free.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.